Well, the podcast can't go on strike. I'm the only one here. Welcome to the Cutting the Gordian Knot podcast. Today we are talking about labor unions. We're going to be examining them from an economic perspective, and then we're going to be digging into what the church has taught regarding these. Some people like to ask, is the church in favor of unions? However, that's not specific enough of a question. That's like saying, is the church in favor of churches? You might say, well, yes, of course, but not the Church of Satan, not the Church of Latter-day Saints, maybe Church's Chicken. If you're not familiar with that one, you need to go visit the hood. Anyways, we need to dig into what kinds of unions are good, what activities they do are promoted by the church, and which ones and how are they condemned, and what cautions does the church give with entrance into and formation of labor unions. There's a ton to cover, and I'm not going to do this justice, but we're going to give it a try nonetheless. We're going to begin with the effect of unions economically, and then we're going to get into some more moral and ethical stuff, and finish up with diving deep into, I think, five different papal encyclicals. So you're in for some fairly good stuff today. First thing I want to point out, there are some findings from a fairly recent paper from the Bureau of Economic Research titled "The Long-Run Impacts of Unions on Firms, New Evidence from Financial Markets." And it's chiefly covering the period from 1961 up to 1999 so that we can track that kind of long-term afterwards, you know, stuff. So here's a really good synopsis that's given by the Bureau of Economic Research, written by Linda Gorman. Let me read this little snippet to you. From the simulation suggests that a policy-induced doubling of unionization in the United States would lead to a 4.3% decrease in the equity value of all firms at risk of unionization. The decrease in equity value associated with unionization begins at the time the union wins its election and continues for about 15 months afterwards. Calculations of the effects of a union victory suggest that it produces large negative returns of 10 to 14%. The authors also find that the effects are quite variable depending on the degree of support for the union. When unions win elections with a bare majority, there's almost no union effect. But when unions win by a large margin, the effect can be as large as 25 to 40%, which is enormous. Their calculation suggests that if the true union wage effect were 8%, this would imply a 2% efficiency loss attributable to unions as priced by the market. So if there is a total $1 loss, then 80 cents of that could be paid to the labor unions, and 20% of that would simply be just an efficiency hit right there. Now, there are many things going on in this article, and I actually encourage you to check it out. Maybe I can even link it in the podcast if I get around to it. It seems that there's some other effects which happen after unionization, and the biggest one is that the increase in wages come at the expense of an increase in assets, which I think is what we should expect. So their research shows that short-term profitability can actually be pretty stable, even after a union victory or a union pay raise of some type. But though they can maintain profitability in the short term, that comes at the expense of long-term profitability. They cut those assets that they would have purchased, and they also cut research and development. So that's a really scary thing for long-term profitability, and that's a really scary thing for the economy writ large if we want sustained economic growth. Now, if you're wondering what the impact would be, not just as a percentage, but as an actual number, it turns out every new union member reduces the value of a company by over $40,000 at the point of unionization. That's bad. So it's a $40,000 hit it takes for every newly unionized worker. Again, some of that is because they're reducing the value of a firm because it's paying out over what the market would have set for wages. But turns out about 20% of that is just lost value. Nobody wins from it. It's simply inefficiency that comes from unions doing their union thing. Now, I looked at a few of the numbers here and figured out some countrywide effects. So we look at what would happen if we doubled the unions. I decided to check out to see what would happen if everybody was unionized. I mean, that would be terrible. And after plugging in a bazillion numbers, it turns out that I simply confirmed, what the article already showed, and that is, it seems to track with that 20% loss of efficiency for every, so for every 80 cents paid to a worker, there's a 20 cent loss of efficiency, and that seems to track even if it expanded past what the paper initially writes about. Alrighty, where on earth am I at? I think I have some stuff from the Heritage Foundation. Yes. So, they report that the decrease in assets is pretty catastrophic, and it's specifically targeting people or targeting firms which are in very like high-tech industries, and it seems that they're able to maintain that profitability as discussed in the first article only by slashing their R&D, and companies which don't have that type of opportunity tend to not be able to pay out those union workers much at all. So even though they come to the table and demand higher wages, it's simply impossible. So it's not pulling higher wages from companies who don't have cash to pay. Does that make any sense? I think it does. Basically, if you're a company which is going to be deploying money to purchase assets and to do R&D, then there's blood to be sucked out of you. If you're not, you're already just in a competitive industry, which is not seeing a lot of changes, not seeing a lot of investment, well, then you're kind of at like this point of homeostasis where, yeah, they can bargain hard, but there's just not much to get over the long term. So that's very scary that it's specifically targeting the industries which could be experiencing growth and could be experiencing really cool technological increases. I want to give you an example of an industry which is heavily unionized in the U.S. and is facing non-unionized labor. That would be the car industry. They've been in the news lately, and they've been extracting higher and higher wages from Ford, from Stellantis, from GM. But they haven't done so to other companies which compete in the same space. So right now, the average total hourly compensation for a unionized General Motors employee is $69 an hour. Yes, you heard that right. That's a lot of money. But they compete head-to-head with Toyota, and Toyota only has to pay $48 an hour for total compensation for the average worker. That's an enormous difference. And by the way, that's just American labor. I'm not talking about this is over in Japan or in other places. When we compare head-to-head American labor, which is unionized versus not unionized, that's the difference. Now, for a vehicle, labor costs are 15% of a vehicle's sale value, which means Toyota has a built-in 6.5% price advantage in an industry that has, on average, a 7.5% profit margin. In other words, they get the opportunity to almost double the profit versus a GM because they're not being sucked dry by a labor union. So in real terms, a new Chevy Blazer, for instance, ought to cost $2,300 less. And that can really make a big difference. It particularly makes a difference not in SUVs and trucks, but in small cars and sedan markets, which American manufacturers have had to exit. So the only sedan that Ford makes is now the Mustang. The only one that GM makes is the Malibu, and I think that's, what, 9 years old and hasn't got a refresh? So in these markets, the cost-conscious consumer cares a lot about $1,000 to $3,000, which is the advantage that Toyota and other Japanese and Korean makers have over the unionized companies like GM, Ford, and Stellantis. People think, well, it's just a fair free market, and maybe these non-American manufacturers are just better, and maybe they're more efficient. Well, I guess maybe, but I would venture to guess if GM had that additional 6.5%, it could compete head-to-head and a lot more effectively. So yeah, it very well could be that the unions shot themselves in the foot and that they don't get the opportunity to have their workers build sedans because, well, the manufacturers just priced out of doing it. So what's the long-term effect on these companies? Well, they seem to be missing the whole development train. They were not the leaders in autonomous technology. They were not the leader in hybrid technology. They were not the leader in all-electric technology. Think of those things what you will. Instead, they were forced to just pay higher wages. And it took startup companies like Tesla to come and do the actual development. That's a problem. Long term, that could mean that we get our entire business crushed. We saw this back when the Japanese cars first hit American shores. There were unionized labor groups that were driving up cost, and we couldn't compete with that. And they almost got wiped out. If you survey history, you'll find that car companies go bankrupt quite often. And a lot of that can be at the feet of the unions. So let's talk about how these unions get their raises and get their increased benefits. I want to begin with a thought experiment to kind of look at the morality of such things. Let's say instead of unions getting together, getting all the potential workers together and trying to jack up their wages, let's pretend that the other side did that. Let's pretend the car companies, the firms themselves, decided to get together and pump up car prices and just agree that they're going to set a floor of how low car prices can go, and none of them will go underneath that because, you know, they don't want to compete with each other. Well, that's cartel behavior. That is extraordinarily illegal. It's illegal for good reason. It's morally wrong. It's economically destructive. It harms the consumer. You can't just use collusion in order to drive up your own profitability like this. You have to compete fairly and freely in a market which doesn't rely on coercion, doesn't rely on just secret backroom deals and economic exploitation, but instead, your compensation should be based on how much value you can deliver. But all of a sudden, when we get to laborers, we just throw all this thinking out the window, and we somehow allow for them to band together and raise the amount that they get over what free and fair competitive wages would set. We do not live in some type of coal mining industrial 1800s world. No, last I checked, there were more jobs on offer than people seeking jobs. There's a ton of opportunity for people to choose whichever job they like. And overall, job satisfaction has been rising almost every single year to record highs recently. People are very happy with their jobs, and that's because employers have to compete in order to get employees. That's been very much highlighted recently, where we've seen massive wage gains, particularly for the lower income stratas. Well, at least a year or so ago, it was a record high. Because there's a shortage of laborers, so people had to compete. That's how prices ought to get set, not by just agreeing to set an arbitrary price floor in order to raise profitability for selling your labor. That's just as wrong as if people got together to create a price floor and raise the profitability of their firm. We gotta be fair here, guys. Now, it's not just that they collude to raise the minimum. They also collude to restrict supply. of course, if we restrict supply, it increases the price of something. And that's what unions do all of the time. They try to get less of their type of labor, not more, and with very few exceptions. They do this by increasing educational requirements, increasing apprenticeship requirements, licensing requirements, and many more things. But what they always end up doing is raising the price for their people who are already in the union at the expense of people who would wish to work that job. They benefit from decreasing the quantity of this type of labor that they're representing. And that's a problem. If you've studied microeconomics, you'd know that the supply and demand graph would look like what would happen if you institute a quota, right? Because a quota would be arbitrarily reducing the supply lower than what the market would set at the point of equilibrium. If you looked at a quota graph, you'll notice that the supply curve would shift up the graph as the total amount of supply decreases, and the consumer surplus would fall as the producer surplus would rise. In other words, the producer of, in this case, the labor will get more, and then the consumer of, in this case, the labor will get less. So they're flexing their market power here. And sadly, for both parties, both the consumer and the producer, there is a shared deadweight loss. That is the little triangle to the left of the point of equilibrium. This is just lost value. And that's what we were talking about earlier with that 20% just plain old lost value when there's a unionization event. There's a change in the quantity of labor supplied. That has a shift in the consumer and producer surplus split, and that's captured in higher wages for the unions. And then that loss of efficiency, which we have seen in not just the paper I referenced, but plenty of others, is representative of the deadweight loss. If you really wanted to get tricky, you could even plot that yourself and then estimate what amount of supply change that would be based on that deadweight loss. So you can draw your own triangles at home. You might be thinking, couldn't excessive market power of a company create a deadweight loss? So if excessive market power, so if that kind of cartel-like behavior in a union can create deadweight loss and economic efficiency, could the same thing happen with companies? And the answer is yes, and it used to happen occasionally. No, not as much as probably popularly represented. Let's take a company mining town where there's only one purchaser of labor. Well, wages could be driven too low in this case, below what a competitive labor market would set. Why? Well, because we have a very powerful economic actor, a monopoly, purchasing all of the labor, so that split of consumer and producer surplus is in favor of, in this case, the consumer of the labor. And this does indeed create a sad little triangle of deadweight loss. So in this case, it could be reasonable to balance out this effect by meeting this monopoly with a similar monopoly, where a union could oppose a company town. And what happens in this case is a more fair wage. That's what I want. I want a fair wage at the end of the day. I want one that would most accurately represent a free and fair market where there is a variety of suppliers, a variety of consumers of labor, and then a price that's set at the market point of equilibrium. That's what I want. And that's not what happens in a company town. So in those cases, a strong union can get the wage closer to what a market would have been. It gets that producer and consumer surplus split more evenly, and we can avoid a lot of the deadweight loss. There is such thing as paying people too little, less than what we ought to. And there's a further point here that's made by Adam Smith. Adam Smith says that, I wish I had the quote for you, but I think it's at the beginning of The Wealth of Nations. You could probably find it. Adam Smith talks about a minimum wage of sorts. He talks about how if you don't pay people enough to live and raise kids, Well, you don't get workers anymore because they die. Or at very least, they would have to have less children because they can't support them. And then that contracts the labor supply, which increases wages. So long term, there's going to have to be some type of living wage in order to keep people living. I think that's quite clear. And he says for this reason, there is no use, there is no rationale in putting your wages below what would support a family, because they're just going to pop back up later. That's just a fool's game. So in this case, when the church says in its various documents that companies ought to support a living wage such that somebody can support their family and even have a little bit of savings, well, this is just like Adam Smith type stuff. Don't read that as if it's the church courageously standing up against these awful neoliberal free market absolutists, blah, 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 whatevers. No, that's father of economic stuff. He says that we should do this. This is a good convention. We should keep that in place. It's a fool's errand to dip it below. And then we should obviously offer this type of wage. And then the literature right now can show that higher wages in general can make sense. And, well, that's quite obvious because not everybody in the economy receives the minimum possible wage. Almost nobody does. Last time I checked, it's less than 2%. And of that 2%, it's primarily people who are part-time, often people who are doing work which would borderline volunteer, and finally people who are teenagers and getting their foot in the door. So, yeah, it's less than 2% of people receive that. There's very good reason to pay people over what would be a minimum of some type. And that represents attracting the best talent, getting buy-in into your company such that people actually want to bring their talents to bear, and a variety of other reasons. Okay, let's get to our next point about why I don't like most unions. Unions can do a few good things occasionally. It's rare, but it does happen. There are times and places where they're appropriate, and the church affirms this. But here's an area where I think they're awful. They crush meritocracy. Unions often restructure the distribution of wages not based on productivity, which is what it should be based on, workman's worthy of his hire, but instead they'll base it on simple seniority or other factors like education. You can see the teachers union, which I believe the education union in general is the largest union that I know of. And it has a step raise system based on how long you've been there, which doesn't actually represent how good of a teacher you are. We all remember teachers which are incredible and phenomenal. And we all remember ones which were exactly the opposite. The union would want these to be paid based on simple seniority or the level of education. But common sense would want the best teachers to be paid the best wages, and the worst teachers to either not be paid at all, or maybe just receive lower pay. So the union, cutting off meritocracy, is creating injustice, and that's not right. Unions, at their best, make just wages come about, possibly opposing monopolies, or, well, we'll get into the other things later. But this is not an example. Whenever they crush meritocracy and they impose their own distribution scheme of wages, I think that's wrong. And while we're on the subject of teachers, they would love you to think that teachers are underpaid. That is one of their favorite pieces of propaganda. However, the research does not say that. When we match teachers with people with a similar high school GPA, college GPA, similar college achievements in general, it turns out that they outperform their peers in total earnings. Teachers, in general, didn't do that great in school, at least not compared to, the highest performing professions. And when they switch professions, it turns out they take on average, last time I checked, a 6% pay cut. That's kind of unusual, because most of the time, when people change from one type of work to another, they see a pay increase, right? Why wouldn't they? They want to go where there's more money. That's a common reason for changing industries. But not so with teachers. They receive a pay cut. So not only do they make more money than people with similar high school and college achievement, when they leave teaching, they see a pay cut. So that shows that, if anything, their total compensation is more than it, quote, should be, at least if we're matching them to similar people. So, I guess we're talking overall here about how they're getting their higher wages. And we discuss the contraction of supply, seeking to putting a floor, so using cartel-like behavior. Let's talk about where that comes from, right? We already discussed the deadweight loss, so some of their wages come out of economic growth, right? Their increase in wages creates a deadweight loss because it's not the optimal amount that they ought to be paid. They're receiving more than their, quote, fair share, if you will. And yeah, they're getting an increase in wages based off of taking away from economic growth that would have benefited everybody. And don't think of people in unions as like the most poor and oppressed among us. It turns out that if you're in a union, on average, you receive about 18% more than an average worker. So these are already above average workers who are getting their above average wages by hurting growth, which, I mean, hurting economic growth disproportionately harms the poorest among us. I don't think that's fair. And we discussed how they get their increased wages at the expense of our international competitiveness. So we're competing against Toyota and Honda and Hyundai and Kia and all these other manufacturers with one hand behind our back. I mean, what was it, 68 versus 45 an hour? Wow. When 15% of the total cost is that labor, and we haven't even talked about whatever effects along the supply chain are going to be going on here, that's not okay. That's not a free and fair competitive environment with which to compete. It's just not. The next is they're getting their higher wages at the cost of what would have been the highest performing workers in their segments' salaries, right? So the sluggard, terrible, awful teachers that we all remember are getting their above average pay because the really awesome teacher has been lowered down to their level. That's right. And other unions, say the Teamsters or the United Auto Workers Union, etc., their worst workers are benefiting at the expense of the best workers who ought to be earning more. Also, total employment in the field. They are benefiting from a restriction in supply. They get higher wages because their union restricted the amount of people who could work in that field. There are other non-union entities who do this type of stupid work. One is the American Medical Association, which needs to be, oh my word, disbanded and everybody thrown in jail. They decide as if they knew how many doctors there should be, which is insane. And they'll do things like allocate how many spots a college can have to train a new doctor. And this reduces the amount of people who can become a doctor. That raises the cost for all of us. That means that they get these incredible bloated salaries. It means that the competition to become a doctor is unbelievably fierce and that the hours you have to put in as a doctor are incredibly high because there's just not enough. It can increase wait times. It can do all sorts of terrible things. Ugh, don't get me started on the medical establishment stuff. There's restriction to supply all over the place and it's criminal. Compared to 1970, we have a third the hospital beds per capita that we had. And then we're surprised that the price went up? Ugh. Too much rage. All right. The last group that it is taking from in order to pay these higher wages are those not in a union. Now, it's true that sometimes that restriction of supply can help the people who aren't in a union, so all their wages rise. That can be true. However, often, when the union makes exclusive deals with those purchasing their type of labor, this pushes out people who don't have that type of ability to do these large-scale sales of labor. So it can hurt those people who aren't in the union. Now, I noted earlier that not all unions are created equal. Unions can be pretty different, right? So they can be as different as churches. Church of Satan, Church of, the Catholic Church, Latter-day Saints and Church's Chicken. Well, Unions are very different in other countries. For instance, in Germany, German unions are basically the opposite of U.S. unions. Unions there commonly fight not to increase workers' wages, but to decrease workers' wages. It seems that they have stifled wage increases for German workers for decades because they want to expand the number of people in their union. And they want to decrease the cost of German manufactured goods in order to make their exports artificially cheap and to keep the overall industrial center in Germany strong. Now, what they have in common with American unions is by artificially changing the quantity of labor that is supplied in the market to be different than what a free market would do in its point of equilibrium in a nice, free, fair economy, they've created a deadweight loss. So they are creating a less efficient economy, not a more efficient economy. And if you're a worker there, you should be particularly upset. They're literally bargaining against you, which is pretty messed up. But you can't really do anything about it because those unions hold seats on the board. I believe a third of Volkswagen board seats are held by their union, though. And, well, others are held by, like, Lower Saxony, etc. Pretty messed up stuff over there. Now, at this point, you must be wondering, wait a minute. There are unions which have incentives to decrease wages by increasing the supply to secure their sector's continued growth and increase jobs and stay internationally competitive so their union can continue. But this hurts the economy as a whole through deadweight loss. And weirdly, at other times, we have them with incentives to increase the wages by decreasing the quantity of workers. And this can give their workers more benefits, more money. But this hurts the economy as a whole through deadweight loss. Why don't they just do neither? Or why don't we just understand that if there's incentives to do an oversupply and an undersupply, maybe we could just split the difference and just have what the market would set? And then we skip the deadweight loss as a whole, and there's a bigger economic pie to split for everybody else. And then we're not just inflating prices for all of us consumers, of which all of us are consumers, and trying to drive up our own wages. Let's just put all of our economic weapons down, not try to just jump up our own labor amount, and live in a richer and more productive world as a result. And that is the conclusion I think you should be drawing economically. Okay, so to wrap it up, the union workers' higher wages come from three main sources. One, corporate profits, and we've discussed that. So to raise your wages that 80 cents, you're destroying 20 cents in economic value for everyone, just gone. In order to add a unionized worker, we're destroying $40,000 of company value, which is pretty messed up. And lower corporate profits sound like just a corporate problem, but it's not. It's a problem for retirees. It's a problem for public and private pensions. So if it's a public pension, which is having $40,000 worth of the company that they invested its value drop, well, they're going to have to raise taxes because they can't expect as high of a return. So we're going to have to pay higher taxes because corporate profits fall. And your private pension is going to have to pull more from your paycheck in order to give you the same benefit. You are going to have to save more in order to have more for retirement because you can't expect companies to be as profitable and be returning you as many dividends and as much capital appreciation because we're just destroying corporate profits. And that hurts more people than just the monopoly man with the monocle or without the monocle or whatever. Also, it's coming from consumers. When we have unions which are, say, driving the UPS wages up to $170,000 in total competition, guess who ends up footing that bill eventually? You, when you order your package on Amazon and it's delivered by UPS. When they get their wage up to $68, $70 an hour at a GM plant or higher now, I heard Ford and I think Stellantis just signed on some type of agreement with the United Auto Workers Union to raise wages before the strike hit. That materializes in higher transportation costs, higher vehicle cost, right? Let's take another example. When dock workers over on the East Coast making $200K a year or something strike and shut down all economic activity that would have come from trade on the West Coast, they're just harming the common good and increasing overall prices for everybody. Or when the railroad workers would strike, and I think they were making $145,000 a year on average per worker, and then they demanded over $160,000 per worker, they're increasing the cost of everything that goes on a railway for consumers. And by the way, I think you remember the whole accident in East Palestine, Ohio. Well, that was in part because of a shortage of workers. Why did they have a shortage of workers, I wonder? Well, because they cost like $160,000 each. If they were more reasonable in cost, if they represented a more average total compensation package, then maybe the railroad company wouldn't have been understaffed. And you might be thinking, yeah, but it was also a maintenance issue. But recall, economic research shows that companies have to reduce their spending on assets. That includes maintenance when unions are strangling them and pulling all of their profits out. So we should expect more accidents, more problems like this, more delayed maintenance, more aging infrastructure when we have unions extracting wages above what the market would set in a free and fair environment. And finally, the last, just to remind you, is it just takes it right out of economic growth. Yeah, that's it. So we, economy-wide, just back of the envelope, I'd have to double check. But if economy-wide, everybody was in a union, and we multiply that massive hit to growth across all sectors, that would cut our growth approximately in half, which is devastating. For one economic change, good night. That would mean that a variety of years, which would have been just slow growth or low growth, would be recessions. Oh, goodness, guys. So the cost is vast. And if it expands, it would be even more vast. Luckily, unions have been declining since the 70s at a pretty marked rate, in large part because, well, they're not as necessary because it's very easy to switch jobs nowadays. But that's not all of their bad economic effects. No, it's not just that they take from people and destroy value and destroy firm competitiveness, et cetera, things we've been over. They're also the loudest voice advocating for restrictive licensing, which I think is totally messed up. Let's take an example. Let's say we have a labor, either union or just a labor association of some type. We don't just have to pick on unions, but trade associations will commonly come to government to explain how they need very strict licensing laws in the state. You might think to yourself, well, why would they want restrictions on their own type of labor? That's simple, because let's say they're electricians. They're already electricians. They don't want new electricians to come and compete with them and to lower their wages. So trade associations for electricians and plumbers, etc., will commonly be the only voices lobbying government to have long apprenticeship periods, to have strict licensing, to have education requirements which block people from being able to enter the field and compete with their particular type of labor. That is wrong. That is messed up. That is immoral. That is totally immoral. And I see that all the time because I work in the trades. I've wired and plumbed many houses and done many HVAC things and done framing and everything. But I can only do it because I exploit a little loophole where if you own a house or own the land and you can get an overall contractor's license, you can do things. But if you want me to change a ceiling fan under my company, I can't do it, as dumb as that is. I can build you a house and sell it to you, but with ceiling fans included, but I can't go to your house and install a ceiling fan because I'm not an electrician, and it would take me like 6 years to do it, even though I've wired many houses under my loophole, all permitted, inspected, and to code. It's silly. They just do this in order to get higher wages. So I think that's a huge effect of unions and trade associations, which should not be. We shouldn't have them be the only voice, and currently they are. So this absolutely just cuts off the bottom the bottom rungs of the economic ladder. People who could easily go into the trades are stopped. They're halted. They can't do it because of these trade associations and unions. And I think that that is a huge part of income inequality. And listen, I'm not one of those income inequality people, because most of the time the income inequality is just a myth, or they haven't looked into all of the pertinent factors. And we've gone over that in some of our economic myths episodes, which I invite you to check out. But this one's real. If it's income inequality because a group of people decided to selfishly restrict the supply of their particular type of labor just to hurt other people and extract more than what the market would have had, and people can't earn in that sector because of this gross activity, that's wrong. That's a type of inequality that I think is totally, totally evil, and we ought to oppose. And that's exactly the type that trade associations and unions are always doing. Now, there's more bad things with unions, but I think we'll get into that as we read from some of the papal encyclicals. The last one I'll just mention here is the rampant political corruption. I even found a Democratic Party political research article that's talking about how they want to push more people into unions because there seems to be a 3-5% effect on people's voting habits when they join a union. Unions tend to make people vote more Democrat. And, I mean, we'll get into why that is. But suffice to say, using them as a political tool is also wrong. And when we see them functioning in the public market, where basically we have public unions which deliver votes to get politicians grant them high wages, the high wages get them to vote more for that party and those politicians. That's the most naked corruption I think I can point to in the U.S. Yes. Okay. All right. You know what? Let's take a very brief break here, and then let's read a lot of papal encyclicals. Of course, we're starting with the granddaddy of them all, Rerum Novarum. See the series I did on that, particularly the last episode, which addressed unions a fair bit. The rest of these encyclicals are actually just kind of riffing off of Rerum Novarum, but they do provide a few helpful clarifications here and there. So, after the very brief break, we're going to be finding out not what economics says about this, which is pretty damning, but what the church says about it, which I think you'll see is pretty damning as well. Okay, this is clipped from Rerum Novarum, paragraph 54, and you can tell me just how supportive of unions it sounds. Associations of every kind, and especially those of working men, are now far more common than heretofore. As regards many of these, there is no need at present to inquire whence they spring, what are their objects, or what the means they imply. Now, there is a good deal of evidence in favor of the opinion that many of these societies are in the hands of secret leaders and are managed on ill principles, according with Christianity and the public well-being, and that they do their utmost to get within their grasp the whole field of labor and force working men either to join them or to starve. Under these circumstances, Christian working men must do one of two things: either join associations in which their religion will be exposed to peril, or form associations among themselves and unite their forces so as to shake off courageously the yoke of so unrighteous and intolerable oppression. No one who does not wish to expose man's chief good to extreme risk will for a moment hesitate to say that the second alternative should, by all means, be adopted. So, Rerum Novarum sees unions at this time as secretly managed on ill principles, seeking to find a monopoly of labor. By the way, that's what I've been decrying, that they reduce the supply of labor, that they block out people from entering into this. In their case, it's choosing between joining this evil organization, which is creating a monopoly, which is being organized on ill principles, and starving. Luckily, starve is not an option, but it doesn't mean that these groups are not still condemned. This is terrible. This creates an extreme risk, it says. It exposes man's chief good to extreme risk. This is called an unrighteous and intolerable oppression. So when we look back and say, oh, the unions were so perfect and so wonderful, that's not what Rerum Novarum says. It had some extreme criticisms. And to this day, there are 23 states which allow unions to force non-union workers to pay dues, whether they like it or not. And public unions can just take money out of people's paychecks. And even in places where they can't necessarily do that, many unions can still force people under law to give them money, even if they're not in the union, under the fair share fee, so that they can then go and do their collective bargaining. And their collective bargaining is, to quote Rerum Novarum quite often, seeking to put the whole field of labor under their control, right? So that's a lot of condemnation, guys. Let's talk about what Rerum Novarum proposes instead. Because again, union is a word which people equivocate on all the time. There are certain unions or coming togethers which are not awful, not on ill-managed principles, not against the common good, not seeking to use monopoly power to harm others in the myriad of ways we've already discussed. Let's talk about the ones which Catholics started and are approved of by Rerum Novarum, even supporting. And recall, these are the ones which it offers as an alternative to the other unions, which are viewed as pretty dangerous to one's soul. Picking up on paragraph 55. Those Catholics are worthy of all praise, and they are not a few who, understanding what the times require, have striven by various undertakings and endeavors to better the conditions of the working class by rightful means. They have taken up the cause of the working man and have spared no efforts to better the condition of both families and individuals, to infuse a spirit of equity into the mutual relations of employers and employed, to keep before the eyes of both classes the precepts of duties and the law of the Gospels. That gospel which, by inculcating self-restraint, keeps men within the bounds of moderation and tends to establish harmony among the divergent interests and the various classes which compose the body politic. It is with such ends in view that we see men of eminence meeting together for discussion, for the promotion of concerted action, and for practical work. Others again strive to unite working men of various grades into associations, helping them with their advice and means to enable them to obtain fitting and profitable employment. The bishops, on their part, bestow their ready goodwill and support, and with their approval and guidance, many members of the clergy, both secular and regular, assist arduously in behalf of the spiritual interest of the members of such associations. And there are not wanting Catholics blessed with affluence who have, as it were, cast in their lot with the wage earners, and who have spent large sums in founding and widely spreading benefits and insurance societies, by means of which the working men may without difficulty acquire through his labor not only many present advantages, but also the certainty of honorable support in ages to come. How greatly such manifold and earnest activity has benefited the community at large is too well known to require us to dwell upon. We find therein grounds for most cheering hope in the future, provided always that the associations we have described continue to grow and spread and are well and wisely administered. The state should watch over these societies of citizens banded together in accordance with their rights, but it should not thrust itself into their peculiar concerns and their organization. For things move and live by the spirit inspiring them and may be killed by the rough grasp of a hand from without. So here's some things that it found praiseworthy. It likes that groups of working men can grade labor. I really like that. And I think we can skip over that quickly. Imagine that there's a bunch of immigrants coming to the shore and they don't speak the language and there is no internet. And one of them is, say, a really skilled stonemason. How is he going to tell anybody that? How is he going to explain that he actually knows exactly how to build a really complex stone structure in another language to people who might not believe him? Well, if he comes to, say, the Stoneworkers Union, they will recognize that, oh, this guy's one of us. He really knows his stuff. He's this level. He is a master craftsman. That is really useful, and it helps to absorb labor, which would not have been profitably deployed otherwise. Awesome. Love it. We kind of got the internet now and, you know, don't exactly have these problems. But hey, at that point, vital. Also, how would this person even know where to find work? Where are the projects that would match his skills? Where do you start? Okay, you come to Ellis Island, let's say. Where do you go from there? You don't know. Maybe you could look at the newspaper and look for an ad or something in a language you don't speak or don't speak well. Or maybe you just go to one of these trade associations or unions and they say, hey, here are the places where there are large-scale needs of labor. We can understand how good you are and we can plug you into a place where you can use your talents. I wholeheartedly support this. In addition, it talks about insurance and benefit programs. And yeah, they didn't have a thriving insurance sector, so they would create mutual benefit societies. Wonderful. Big fan. And because they particularly knew the risks that they were taking in each trade, then they could judge the value of an insurance policy and what the premiums ought to be, etc. This is wonderful. Mm-hmm. That's a good free market activity. I like it. I also like how it points out that a lot of rich Catholics jumped in and helped these guys out, and that it opposes the state coming and thrusting itself into the particular concerns of these. I think today we often jump to what can the state do. That's not what Rerum Novarum is praising. It's saying, hands off, state. You can kill good things with your rough grasp. But it's actually wonderful when people throw their lot in with the working class and they help people with their wealth. That's supported. And also, this is a very religious organization. We see the clergy, both secular and regular, laboring arduously on behalf of the spiritual interests of the members of such associations. And this is a theme we'll see later on, that it wasn't just a secular organization just centered around class warfare. That's condemned. Instead, these were religious organizations of virtues, which helped each other be supported in their times of need, and assisted them in deploying their talents in the best way possible for the common good. The language we see here is one of self-restraint, bounds of moderation, tends to the harmony between the divergent interests, and it's not about class struggle, it's about class unity in the body politic amongst labor and capital. Unions are not like this typically. They're often antagonistic, they focus on strikes, other means by which they can promote themselves at the expense of the company, which they're bleeding dry in all the ways that we talked about earlier. All right, it continues with a bit of a summary, so we will read that. To sum it up then, we may lay it down as a general and lasting law that working men's associations should be so organized and governed as to furnish the best and most suitable means for attaining what is aimed at. That is to say, for helping each member to better his condition to the utmost in body, soul, and property. It is clear they must pay special and chief attention to the duties of religion and morality, and that social betterment should have this chiefly in view. Otherwise, they would wholly lose their special character and end by becoming little better than those societies which take no account whatsoever of religion. What advantage can it be to a working man to obtain by means of a society material well-being if he endangers his soul for lack of spiritual food? What doth it profit a man if he gain the whole world and suffer the loss of his soul? This, as our Lord teaches, is the mark of character that distinguishes the Christian from the heathen. After all these things do the heathen seek. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his justice, and all these things shall be added to you. Let our associations then look first and before all things to God. Let religious instruction have therein the foremost place, each one being carefully taught what is his duty to God, what he has to believe, what to hope for, and how he is to work out his salvation. And let all be warned and strengthened with special care against wrong principles and false teaching. Let the working man be urged and led to the worship of God, to the earnest practice of religion, and among other things, to keep holy Sundays and holy days. Let him learn to reverence and love Holy Church, the common mother of us all, and hence to obey the precepts of the Church and to frequent the sacraments, since they are the means ordained by God for obtaining forgiveness of sin and leading a holy life. What union have you ever heard that would meet that? That's what the church wants. That's what it wants an association of working men to look like. Is that what you thought of when you heard of a union? Does that look like the Teamsters? Does that look like the education union? Does that look like the United Auto Workers Union? No, it doesn't. Those look a lot more like those heathen associations who don't look to God, but instead seek to just profit, seek to just take, seek to foment class warfare for their own sake, and they're not governing their actions according to gospel principles. They're not looking to others as greater than themselves. So, to sum up, a good trade organization should teach the faith, it says, encourage religion, create cooperation, not hostility between labor and capital, organize life and disability insurance programs, rank labor, sort labor into projects, and offer training and education. All of those things are great. All of those things I support. And all of those things, even a raging free market fanboy can also and should also support. Those all make the market better, not worse. They make society better, not worse. They make the plight of the worker better, not worse. Let's move on to... oh, I'm going to butcher all these names. Quadricio, I don't know, whatever. Yeah, oh my goodness, yes. Prepare for my terrible destruction of the Latin language. Okay. It endorses Catholic labor unions first, kind of like what we were talking about with Rerum Novarum. Then it goes on to say the following. It is clearly the office of bishops, when they know that these associations are an account of circumstances necessary and are not dangerous to religion, to approve of Catholic workers joining them, keeping before their eyes, however, the principles and precautions laid down by our predecessor, Pius X, of holy memory. Among these precautions, the first and chief is this. Side by side with these unions, there should always be associations zealously engaging and imbuing and forming their members in the teaching of religion and in morality, so that they in turn may be able to permeate the unions with a good spirit, which should direct them in all their activity. As a result, the religious associations will bear good fruit even beyond the circle of their own membership. To the encyclical of Leo, therefore, must be given this credit, that these associations of workers have so flourished everywhere that while, alas, still surpassed in numbers by socialist and communist organizations, they already embrace a vast multitude of workers and are able, within the confines of each nation, as well as in wider assemblies, to maintain vigorous the rights and legitimate demands of Catholic workers and insist also on the salutary Christian principles of society. So, in this section, we see that the Catholic societies are put in direct opposition to the socialist and communist organizations. These would be the ones that are managed on ill principles, the ones which are full of the heathens. And this document asks that the Catholic associations not only care for those in their own membership, but also work to imbue morality and religion into the unions so that the unions can take on a good spirit to direct them in their activity, so that they're not being directed by the evil socialist and communist spirits instead. All righty. Let's see. This particular one goes on to paragraph 94 and states strikes and lockouts are forbidden. If the parties cannot settle their dispute, public authority intervenes. Now, when you think of unions, you probably think of strikes, but this encyclical actually says you can't strike. Now, later ones actually allow for it so long as it's not grievously injuring the common good. But I do want to point out that we commonly think of, a union is a great tool with which to strike in order to get whatever things. But at least this encyclical imagines that the rights of workers can be protected, the interest of workers can be promoted, that the good life can be had while not striking, doing lockouts, and not creating this adversarial class warfare on which they so often depend. Laborium nexen something and rather. This is paragraph 20, The Importance of Unions. All these rights, together with the needs of the workers themselves to secure them, give rise to yet another right, the right of association. That is, to form associations with the purpose of defending the vital interests of those employed in the various professions. These associations are called labor or trade unions. The vital interests of the workers are to a certain extent common for all of them. At the same time, however, each type of work, each profession, has its own specified character, which should find a particular reflection in these organizations. Now, there's a huge point here, which gets repeated in their next encyclical, and that is the church sees the right to be in a union as a derivative of the right of free association. Okay, remember that. Unions undermine this very basis of their own existence when they attack the right of association. Recall, I went through a variety of ways in which unions can force non-union workers to pay their dues, to support their own political causes, to have to deal with all the terrible stuff that they're setting down. That's destroying freedom of association. We don't have a freedom in every state to say no to a union and yes to the type of labor contract that you yourself negotiate freely and fairly with the employer of your choice. So unions, when they fight against your right of free association, are undermining their principle of their own existence. They exist because you have a right of free association. That's like a gun store deciding to attack the Second Amendment. It's just entirely destroying their own foundation. That's how messed up some of these are. Next paragraph. In a sense, unions go back to the medieval guilds of artisans insofar as these organizations brought people together, belong to the same craft, and thus on the basis of their work. However, unions differ from the guilds on this essential point. The modern unions grew up from the struggle of workers in general, but especially the industrial workers, to protect their rights vis-a-vis the entrepreneurs and the owners of the means of production. Their task is to defend the existential interests of the workers in all sectors in which their rights are concerned. The experience of history teaches that organizations of this type are an indispensable element of social life, especially in modern industrial societies. Obviously, this does not mean that only industrial workers can set up associations of this type. Representatives of every profession can use them to ensure their own rights. Thus, there are unions of agricultural workers, of white-collar workers. There are also employers' associations, all of which have been said can be divided into further groups or subgroups according to the particular professional specializations. I will point, we often point out that many Catholic sources have this glowing idea of guilds, and they really shouldn't. I always cringe when people put guilds on a pedestal. Yeah, they were okay for their members sometimes, but they also did some really screwed up stuff, one of which is destroying technological development. Maybe I'll do a short episode on that one day. But they don't want technological development going on because it could basically make all their skills null and void. They also really screwed over people who were young and entering their trade, commonly just leeching off their work in order to give more money to the people who were older and more powerful in the guild. So we get the apprentice and journeyman and all sorts of stuff going on there. because of guilds. And journeyman is because people couldn't make enough money to be in one area. They were forced to go town to town to just sell their labor. They were on the road the whole time. They were journeymen, away from their family, away from their communities, because of the guilds. So don't think, oh, guilds were great. Guilds did a lot of screwed up stuff. I don't really like guilds. Occasionally, they fostered some really high-level labor, but we got to be clear-eyed about these. Next, yes, Industrial Revolution workers had it tough, but you do have to ask compared to what? Like, why were they flocking to the cities? Oh, because agriculture had become unprofitable such that they could have died if they continued doing that, because there's no ability to sustain their lifestyle at that point. So it's not enough to just say, hey, this was bad. We always have to ask in economics compared to what? So we got to be reasonable about this. Now they mention these entrepreneurs, these capitalists and whatnot. At least a lot of the time in the Industrial Revolution, they were kind of great. We have Rockefeller, Morgan, Ford, Carnegie, especially Carnegie was an incredible person, giving us public libraries and giving us Grand Central Station and all sorts of incredible stuff. The effect of their wealth continues today in the form of all sorts of foundations, some of which have gone rogue, but some of which still do some great work. And finally, people have this idea that if you say have $1 billion, that $1 billion somehow making other people poorer. Nothing is less true. Money doesn't get hoarded, right? Money sits in banks or goes to investments or is in bonds, stocks, all sorts of things like that. In other words, it's becoming capital to leverage the labor of the worker. So if you're not consuming it, then it's either being saved or invested, at which point it is turned over to the common good in the form of leveraging one's labor with a larger capital stock. And that means higher productivity. And higher productivity is the only thing that can create sustained higher labor rates. That's it. And we'll get into that a little later. So these guys transformed our nation. Rockefeller, Morgan, Ford, Carnegie, they absolutely like drug us into modernity in the truest sense. They did incredible work and we shouldn't discount them. They were very generous. They were very wise. They were very skilled. They created enormous value and much of their stuff was already turned over to the common good in the form of investment and only their consumption value, which divided amongst workers is next to nothing, was quote unquote hoarded. Let's continue. And I don't think what we just read is really in opposition, but I did want to make those points to kind of frame what it's saying. Catholic social teaching does not hold that unions are no more than a reflection of the class structure of society and that they are a mouthpiece for a class struggle which inevitably governs social life. There you go. So when people think unions, oh, struggle, oh, just the workers against the capitalists, that's not Catholic. Catholic social teaching does not hold this. You just heard it. For the rights of the working people in accordance with their individual professions. However, this struggle should be seen as a normal endeavor for the just good. There you go. So it's not just a class struggle. It's not about doing that. It's about being a vehicle for what is just, the just good. In the present case, for the good which corresponds to the needs and merits of working people associated by profession. But it is not a struggle against others, even if in controversial questions the struggle takes on the character of opposition towards others. This is because it aims at the good of social justice, not for the sake of struggle or in order to eliminate the opponent. It is characteristic of work that at first and foremost unites people. In this consists its social power, the power to build a community. In the final analysis, those who work and those who manage the means of production or who own them must in some way be united in this community. In the light of this fundamental structure of all work, in the light of this fact, in the final analysis, labor and capital are indispensable components of the process of production in any social system. It is clear that even if it is, because of their work, needs that people unite to secure their rights, their union remains a constructive factor of social order and solidarity, and is impossible to ignore it. There you go. Nothing could be clearer. Unions are not about class struggle. They are not about just getting from other people. They are not about eliminating your opponent. They are not about destroying community. They are not about alienating one group from another. They're about forming a common community. They are about understanding that labor and capital are, quote, indispensable components of the process of production in any social system. And this, it claims, is impossible to ignore. But it goes on. Just efforts to secure the rights of workers who are united by the same profession should always take into account the limitations imposed by the general economic situation of the country. Union demands cannot be turned into a kind of group or class egotism, although they can and should also aim at correcting with a view to the common good of the whole society, everything defective in the system of ownership or the means of production or in a way that they are managed. Social and socioeconomic life is certainly like a system of connected vessels of every social activity directed towards safeguarding the rights of particular groups should adapt into the system. All right. This is a great paragraph coming up. We're going to have to... Oh, yeah. I guess we're almost through. But I'm going to have to take a brief break. Hang on, guys. I'll be right back. We discussed politics a little bit here. Here's what this document has to say. Quote, in this sense, union activity undoubtedly enters the fields of politics, understood as the prudent concern for the common good. However, the role of unions is not to play politics in the sense that the expression is commonly understood today. Unions do not have the character of political parties struggling for power. They should not be subjected to the decision of political parties or have too close links to them. In fact, in such a situation, they easily lose context with their specific role, which is to ensure the just rights of workers within the framework of the common good of the whole society. Instead, they become an instrument used for other purposes. Guys, unions today, unions through so much of history, were just dominated by political parties and have this incredibly corrupt reciprocal relationship whereby they become instruments used for political purposes. The church says that they shouldn't have a political character, that they should not be subjected to political decisions, that they should not have too close links to political parties. Boy, do unions today and throughout most of history and pretty much everywhere run afoul of that extraordinarily clear teaching. Let's keep going. Speaking of the protection of the just rights of workers according to their individual professions, we must, of course, always keep in mind that which determines the subjective character of work in each profession. But at the same time, indeed, before all else, we must keep in mind that which conditions the specific dignity of the subject of work. The activity of union organizations opens up many possibilities in this respect, including their efforts to instruct and educate the workers and to foster their self-education. Praise is due to the work of the schools that are known as workers or people's universities and the training programs and courses which have developed and are still developing in the field of this activity. It is always to be hoped for that, thanks to the work of their unions, workers will have more, but above all, in other words, they will realize their humanity more fully in every respect, right? That's awesome. We like education. Education is good. They're realizing their humanity. They are increasing their skills. They're becoming more useful to the common good. We like that. One method used by unions in pursuing the just rights of the workers is the strike or work stoppage as a kind of ultimatum to the competent bodies, especially the employers. This method is recognized by Catholic social teaching as legitimate in the proper conditions and within just limits. In this connection, workers should be assured the right to strike without being subject to personal penal sanctions for taking part in a strike, while admitting that it is a legitimate means, we must at the same time emphasize that a strike remains, in a sense, an extreme means. It must not be abused. It must not be abused especially for political purposes. Furthermore, it must never be forgotten that when essential community services are in question, they must in every case be assured, if necessary, by means of appropriate legislation. Abuse of the strike weapon can lead to the paralysis of the whole of socioeconomic life, and this is contrary to the requirements of the common good of society, which also correspond to the properly understood nature of work itself. Okay, so a good qualified statement that there are times where a strike could work, but we can't screw up the common good, and we can even legislate against that. But we should admit it, even if it is an extreme measure, and not have personal criminal or penal sanctions for it. That's reasonable. And the 100th year. This is the 100th year of Sens Rerum Novarum. We're going to read a few parts here, and then I think we're just going to wrap it on up, guys. This actually went a lot longer than I anticipated. Here we find the reason for the church's defense and approval of the establishment of what is commonly called trade unions. Certainly not because of ideological prejudices or in order to surrender to a class mentality, but because the right of association is a natural right of a human being, which therefore precedes his or her incorporation into political society. Indeed, the formation of unions cannot be prohibited by the state because the state is bound to protect natural rights, not to destroy them. And if it forbids its citizens to form associations, it contradicts the very principle of its own existence. And we already talked about how this is the center of unions. You can get into association, but this should not be an association which is built around ideological prejudices, i.e. socialism, communism, and is not in to surrender to a class struggle mentality, which it so often does. All right. Furthermore, society and the state must ensure wage levels adequate for the maintenance of the worker and his family. We already talked, this is basic Adam Smith stuff, including a certain amount for savings. This is probably my favorite line. This requires a continuous effort to improve workers' training and capability so that their work will be more skilled and productive. Wait, what requires it? Oh, so it's not just that we should demand a, quote, living wage. In order to demand and ensure a wage level adequate for these things, it requires something. A continuous improvement in the training and capability so that workers will be more skilled and productive. Let me give an analogy here. People have all sorts of silly ideas when we talk about economics in the terms of money. So let's not. Let's imagine a potato farmer. This potato farmer can farm 5 potatoes an hour, okay? And how much is the max amount that we could possibly pay him in potatoes? Well, 5 an hour, right? I mean, if we paid him 6 potatoes, we'd run out of potatoes. We couldn't pay him anymore. So we would have to pay him, I don't know, 4 potatoes an hour and then use the extra potato to pay for the potato farming stuff, right? This is about the obvious, most obvious thing ever. But what if he needed more than 5 potatoes? What if 5 potatoes wasn't a living wage for him? Maybe he ate a lot of potatoes, guys. Maybe he had little potato-eating children. So what do we do? Do we just mandate that a 6 potato come out of nowhere? No, that's stupid. That is insane. We would follow what it clearly says. In order to give this wage, we would have to increase his productivity. Because the wage is ultimately set by the productivity of workers. You can't pay them more than what their productivity level, because then you'll run out of potatoes. So let's give this guy a plow. Let's give him a seed drill. That doesn't work. Potatoes don't come from seeds. Anyways, let's give him whatever he needs to do the potato farming so that he can make 20 potatoes. And then maybe he can get 15 potatoes an hour, or however many the market desires to give him in a fair and free economy. There you go. that's something forgotten in discussion, even though it's bleedingly obvious. But there, this is church teaching. Often we get these people running around, oh, the church isn't capitalist. Oh, it is not socialist. It supports unions, and Catholic social teaching is this amazing third thing. It's like, no, listen, it's not. It's pretty much the normal, reasonably conditioned free market stuff that anybody who studies economics would probably give you. This is basic stuff. We can increase people's wages and ensure that they make a decent amount by increasing their productivity. And you can't do it otherwise. Duh. All right, let's finish this little paragraph. As well as careful controls and adequate legislation measures to block shameful forms of exploitation, especially to the disadvantage of the most vulnerable workers, of immigrants, and of those on the margins of society. The role of trade unions in negotiating a minimum salary and working conditions is decisive in this area. Oh, in every single area for every single worker who could have negotiated his own salary? No, for immigrants, right? People who might not be able to even speak the same language. Those who are just dropped in an area because they immigrated over and might not be able to plug in to the labor market very well. For those people who are vulnerable workers in other ways, so their voice is, like, for some reason blunted, their language, through some type of vulnerability, then we can bring them up to a fair bargaining position by them joining a union. I think that could be reasonable. Mm-hmm. And of course, we want to block with legislation shameful forms of exploitation, obviously. Nobody is saying that all we should have is consent as the only principle in the economy. Adam Smith didn't think that. He wrote before The Wealth of Nations, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which we have quoted at length on this podcast. You can see the critique of Tony Bennett's Tony Annette's silly work as he pretends to lay out what Catholic social teaching is in economics. Last paragraph. Finally, humane working hours and adequate free time need to be guaranteed, as well as the right to express one's own personality at the workplace without suffering any affront to one's conscience or personal dignity. Right. So we can't make you act against your conscience, obviously. We can't make people suffer an affront to their personal dignity. We can't treat people less than human. Yes, obviously, those things should always be defended. And adequate free time, it says in Rerum Novarum extensively that this free time should be about caring for family, which is a necessary activity, and the practice of one's religion. All right, where were we? This is the place to mention once more, the role of trade unions, not only in negotiating contracts, but also as places where workers can express themselves. They serve the development of an authentic culture of work and help workers to share in a more fully human way in the life, in their place of employment. All right. So let's just kind of wrap up. What does the church say that a good labor organization does? What creates the necessary conditions for higher wages? So that there can be savings, so that there can be time off, so that there can be all the things that we just listed, so that there can be good worker conditions. And that means increasing productivity. That's through labor allocation and grading and through education. It also very much praises the role of insurance and disability programs. Here's the thing about all this. Most of this is kind of obsolete. Most training is now done by colleges, trade schools, or on-the-job training. Labor allocation is done by sites like Indeed, Monster.com, LinkedIn, and job boards. Labor grading is, at this time in history, via resume, professional licensure, and letters of recommendations and work portfolios. And insurance need not be trade-specific, as it is typically cheapest at scale through major insurance companies. The church opposes all the socialist, communist, class struggle, heathen, secular nonsense that's in unions. It opposes you seeing it as an us versus them. It opposes the restriction of labor. It opposes cutting off the bottom rungs of the ladder. And yeah, there you go, guys. That's what to think about unions from an economic and a religious perspective, as best as I can present it. If you guys have any questions, email them to thegordianknot101@gmail.com. And of course, you can always email me about that or anything else. I'd love to hear from you guys. We do need even more questions for the mailbag, because I want to get that segment up and going again. Share this with a friend, share this with an enemy, share this with whoever you can. And I do invite you to also rate and review this podcast. And thanks for listening.